There is a large group in this religious world who believe and would have you believe, and your young people to believe, that there is no such thing as being guilty by association. In other words, you are perfectly fine being around sin, being associated with sin, so long as you yourself do not participate in that sin. For example, someone might go to a party and be there to what they call in college to be the DD, the designated driver. Maybe you're there at the party and you're not going to drink. You're not going to participate in that and get drunk, but you're going to be there to take somebody home who is going to get drunk. And so you didn't participate, and in fact you're helping someone by taking them home, and so you're not guilty. You didn't do anything wrong in that. Just the ones who were drinking made the mistake. Friends, I hope that by the end of this study tonight, if you don't already feel this way, that you will believe as I do with every fiber of my being that biblically there very much is a such thing as being guilty by association. It does matter where we put ourselves, with whom we associate ourselves, when it comes to Christianity and our walk with God. I want to give you three words this evening by way of introduction that I'll bring up time and time again throughout this study. And I'll reference back to them. And these three words, you might say, are the process or the progression of how this works. It starts with just being there, and it ends with participating. But every bit of this we're going to see is a problem. The first word is consent. First word is consent. And this word is really what we're talking about. You're there and you're present, and the sin is going on around you, but you're not participating. However, you're also not discouraging that activity. You're just there. You're passive. You're standing idly by, if you will. There's no opposition to what's going on around you. That's the word consent. That's what we were going to think about. The second word, maybe the next step in the progression or process, is to condone it. Condoning is a little further than consenting in that you now are giving it your stamp of approval. You're endorsing the action. You approve of it. And then, of course, it would conclude with communing. It's a word we mentioned this morning. The word communion means to share together or shared participation. That's what we're talking about. Then, not only are you not standing there and participating, more so than that, not only are you approving of it, you're actually taking part. You're actually committing that sin along with them. Communing. Now, when it comes to committing the sin, there's not much debate on that. We know that that's wrong. We don't need to do it. Commune, bad. Condoning, for the most part, we in the religious world get that. You can't approve of it, or you're no better than those who are doing it. But it's that consenting where there seems to be a separation. In that, again, so many in this world would have us believe that there's nothing wrong with being there and not standing out against it so long as we don't participate. Consenting to what's going on around us. All right, let's get into this. In the first place, let's talk about the acknowledgement. I'll explain this strange photo in a moment. I could see it on your faces when you saw it. Like, what is that? I'll explain it in a moment. But acknowledgement. And what I mean by this is we must acknowledge together God's line, His clear and vibrant line of demarcation. That is, He has placed a line, a boundary between the world or evil and Christianity or good. There's a clear boundary in which we should not be crossing over back and forth. Okay? Let me get more into this and make more sense of it, hopefully. Colossians 1 and verse 13, the Bible tells us that the Lord has translated us. Other versions say transferred us out of darkness into His marvelous light. There's a line here, and you were once on this side of it in that darkness, and He's transferred or translated you into this side, into His marvelous light, the good side. Right? You once were on the bad, now you're on the good. There's a clear line that separates the two. John 8 verse 34 says that when we're in sin, we are the servants of sin. And so He's got us out of the state of sin, crossed the line into a good state, a state of being faithful, being pure, being innocent. Now here's the point of this. He does not want us, once we've been translated, to cross back over that line and participate with that which He's brought us out of. Okay? Go to 2 Corinthians with me, chapter 6. And I'll explain the photo here. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. I hope you have your Bibles and will meet me there. 2 Corinthians 6. Let's begin in verse 14 together. Passage is probably familiar to you. 2 Corinthians 6:14. Be ye not, Paul writes to the church at Corinth, be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. When Paul says there, do not be unequally yoked, that's a picture he's taking from one of the laws in the Old Testament, which is why this photo is up here. Because in Deuteronomy 22 and verse 10, and passages like it, God had made it very clear that you do not take two animals that are unequally yoked or not of the same breed and put them together. Literally in Deuteronomy 22:10, he says, don't take a mule or a donkey and put it with an ox and go plowing through the field. Those animals are not to be yoked together. Why? Because those two animals, in many cases, are not going to get along. It's not going to go well. And so you need two animals, two oxen of the same kind, that are comfortable with one another so that they'll go smoothly for the farmer and get the work done. Don't put two animals together that don't belong. And so Paul says, with that picture in mind from the old law, don't be unequally yoked. Don't yoke yourself as a believer to an unbeliever, like the ox and the donkey. And then he's going to ask some rhetorical questions. Look at verse 14 again. Rhetorical questions. And remember, a rhetorical question is not a question that needs an answer. The answer is obvious. In fact, the very fact that it is rhetorical says that you already know the answer. You know better. You already know the obvious implication. Look at what he says. For what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? Paul says there's a clear line here. What fellowship does one who is righteous have with someone who is unrighteous, who's committing unrighteousness while you're trying to walk in the light? What communion hath light with darkness? They're literally polar opposites. Where there is light, there is no darkness. Darkness and light don't mingle together. Right? It's rhetorical. What concord or agreement hath Christ with Belial? Or that is literally traced back to Satan. Literally, he's just saying here, what relationship or agreement did Jesus and Satan have together? Satan opposes everything that is Christ and His message. It's rhetorical. Nothing whatsoever. In fact, it's borderline blasphemy to think that they have anything in common. What part hath he that believeth with an infidel or an unbeliever? Unbeliever and believer. Verse 16. What agreement hath the temple of God with idols? Pause here for a moment and keep in mind, Paul is writing to the church in Corinth, and in Corinth is that Acro-Corinthus, which was where the temple of Aphrodite was located. And in that temple of Aphrodite was some thousand or more priestesses who were prostitutes, as we would call them. And in order to worship Aphrodite, men would do so immorally by going to this place. And so with this in mind, he says to them, what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? Notice, for ye are the temple of the living God. He's talking about us physically, our bodies. What purpose or reason do you have to take yourself and put yourself in that situation, right? In that temple or with idols, with idolatry? Ye are, we would say in Alabama anyways, and maybe y'all do in Florida, we'd say y'all. That's plural. Ye, y'all, everyone, what reason do you have as the temple of the living God to be there? As God has said, notice, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. God, through His Word, dwells in us. We know that Christ has bought our body with a price. What business do we have taking our bodies and placing them and surrounding ourselves with the very sin that Christ died to cleanse us of? Verse 17, wherefore, no wonder why Paul would say this, come out from among them and be ye separate. There's a line of demarcation. There's a boundary here, and he says you don't need to cross it. Come out from among them, be ye separate. Look at verse 18, or excuse me, the end of verse 17 rather. Touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. There's not a person in here that does not want the Lord to receive them. Everyone in here wants the Lord to receive them. We don't want to be rejected by God in that day. If we want to be received, if we want that, and I know that we do, we ought to listen to what God says, or what God says through Paul here in this writing. You must be separate from these activities and from those who are committing those activities. Let me take this a step further. Let's go to Ephesians 5 and add some more to this. Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 3. Ephesians 5, beginning in verse 3. Paul would then say this to the church at Ephesus. But fornication, and all uncleanness, or covetousness, let it not be once named among you as becometh saints. Not one time let it be named. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks. Don't let your speech be identified by inappropriate jokes and jesting at others. Let it be rather giving of thanks. Verse 5, for this ye know, that no whoremonger, nor unclean person, nor covetous man, who is an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Sure, Paul, we know that. If you participate in these sins, if you're partaking in them, you're going to be lost. We know that. Verse 6, let no man deceive you with vain words, for because of these things cometh the wrath of God upon the children of disobedience. Don't let anybody deceive you, because what you need to remember, Paul says, is that these sins that they're committing are the very reason that hell exists. They're the very reason that people are going to suffer for all eternity. He says, don't forget that. And therefore, look at the next passage. Where are we? Verse number 7. Be ye not therefore partakers with them. A more modern translation says, do not associate with them. He says, when you are there, whether you're passive or not, when you're there around what's going on, do you realize that it's the sins that are being committed right around you that are the reason that these people are going to suffer for all eternity? We may not think of it that way, right? We're not partaking in this. I'm not worried about it. It doesn't affect me, right? I'm not drinking, or I'm not dancing, or I'm not taking drugs, or whatever might be going on around you. Look at verse 11. Or actually, verse 8, excuse me. Verse 8 first and then verse 11. Notice he says, for ye were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. He says, there's a line here. And once you were on this side of that line, in darkness, but now I've placed you over here in light. He says, so act like it. Walk like it. Live like it. Now look at verse 11. Have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. Don't have fellowship with those works, reprove them. So in other words, if you want to take part in these things, the only reason you would want to be there or to be around it is to rebuke it. That's your goal, that's your job or responsibility when that's going on around you. Right? Think about this for a moment. Let's say you are in that situation, you're at the bar, and they're drinking around you. And let's say you do this. You decide that you're going to rebuke them. You don't need to be doing that. What are they going to say? They're going to look up from that drink or look over their shoulder, and they're going to say, then why are you here? Why are you here? It's not going to do us any good to go to those places and rebuke them. I had a young person. The reason I'm saying this, I had a young person in college in a study we were doing who said, I believe that we ought to go to those parties and we ought to go to those places and teach them in that moment. We ought to tell them and rebuke them for what they're doing. Well, there's a major problem with that, and that is, why are you there? Why would you be there in the first place? There's a time and place to talk with them about that, but being there is not going to be in your best interest. And we're going to continue to see why that is as we go through this. The word here for reprove, though, or rebuke, when that's going on around us, we ought to rebuke it. The word means really two ideas here. Number one is to expose it. Expose it for what it is. And number two is to convict the person that's committing that sin. Expose it and convict them of it. Young people that are wanting to go to prom, let's say, and be there. Are you wanting to go because you want to convict, expose sin? And probably not. You probably want to go because everybody else is, or because you want to have those pictures taken. Why does somebody want to go to a party? Do you want to go to cause them to change their life? Probably not. You want to be there, and maybe you like to be. I've heard people say, I just like to be around drunk people. They're funny. You know, whatever the case, people really think this way. They want to be there and see that. That's fun to them. But we do have and need to acknowledge that there is a line that God has drawn, and we need not cross it. Let me add more to this so that I know that there's no doubt in your mind, hopefully. Let's talk about the attitude now. The attitude. The attitude of love. I want you to 1 John 2 with me. And I promise I'm not about to do another lesson on love. I've done that already. But what I want to talk about here is really a part of love that sometimes we might miss. 1 John chapter 2. But I want to start here to begin with in verse 15. 1 John 2 and verse 15. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. We understand this. You can't love the things in the world and love God. There is that division that we've already been talking about. But I want you to notice something in verse 17. Maybe you've noticed before, maybe not. But as I was reading this and studying it, something jumped out to me that I hadn't thought of before. The world, verse 17, passeth away, and the lust thereof, that he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. I had never really thought about this before, but there's going to come a time when the drunk will not want another drink. It's not going to do it for him. When the fornicator or adulterer is not going to want another experience. When the druggie is not going to want another hit. The world is going to pass away, and the lust or those selfish or fleshly desires will cease as well. Have you ever thought about the fact that those sins that we often commit, the desires of the flesh, those desires aren't even true and real desires in that it's just the flesh talking. It's not even who we really are. Our spirit, right, we often read and sing, the flesh is weak, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is so weak. It's so true. It's the flesh that wants that. And one day when we're changed into that spiritual form, we'll never desire that again. It's not even a real desire. In a sense, it's just imaginary because it's this flesh that's not really who we are that's wanting it. One day, it's not going to do you any good anymore because you won't want it. And instead, we'll spend eternity wishing we had never given in to that desire. Now, what does that have to do with the lesson? Here's the point. Let's go to Psalm... Or actually, let me just mention this one. You can turn there, though, if you like. Psalm 119, 104. Here's what I'm getting at with love. The psalmist says, I love thy precepts because they give me understanding. Literally, he says, through thy precepts I get understanding. Therefore, I hate every false way. We teach our young people, and rightly so, that we need to avoid that word hate. Hate is there's even a song. Hate is a strong word. But I really, really, really don't like you. I think that's on the radio or something like that. But anyways, hate, it's a strong word, and it is. We ought not to hate very many things at all. But there's one thing we ought to hate. And biblical love demands that we hate, and it's sin or Satan. Satan, evil, his ways are the one thing that we have the authority and command to hate. Biblical love is not this love of mealy mouth, no backbone, no spine, cotton candy, and just pat them on the back. You know, by the way, and I don't mean any disrespect to this. Please don't take this the wrong way, but brethren, with all the love I have, we can pat somebody on the back all the way down the road to hell. Think about that. We can pat them on the back all the way, and that's not real love. And I think Larry hit on this a little bit this morning. Real love is going to cause us to want to tell them and how to make that right. Rebuke that with that love, with the proper, in that proper way. What about Romans 12 and verse 9? In fact, it says there that through that love, he says, we ought to abhor evil. Let love be without dissimulation, the beginning of that verse. In other words, without hypocrisy. Let it be genuine. Don't be hypocritical in your love. He says, abhor that which is evil. The word abhor means to utterly detest. It is, I don't want anything to do with it. It is disgusting to me. Hate is just the beginning of that word abhor. Biblical love abhors evil because we love God. And we love His will. And we recognize, again, what evil is doing to the world around us. I had a friend in college, a real good friend of mine, and he despised mayonnaise. I have never in my life seen someone who hated mayonnaise more. And I thought he was just joking. You know, just like, in other words, he didn't like the taste of it. Well, I just, messing with him one day, I took some mayonnaise and I put it on his face when he wasn't watching. I'm not a very good friend, but I didn't know how much... I don't know if he was joking or not, but he started gagging. It was awful. And so because I was such a terrible friend, I decided I would take some more mayonnaise. And he took off running. I mean, we lived upstairs in an apartment. He went downstairs and he took off. And I was a pretty quick little guy. This guy was fairly big. And I couldn't catch him. He despised mayonnaise. He didn't talk to me for some time. I'll never forget that. And it was funny to me at the time. But he literally abhorred mayonnaise. That's what I'm getting at here. This word means you cannot stand it. You don't want to smell it. You don't want to be around it. Here's the point. I feel like some of our brethren must not abhor evil. Because if they really felt that way about it, they wouldn't want to be around it. They wouldn't want to go to the party because they can't stand drinking. Because it's causing people to lose their soul. They don't want to go to the dance. Because lasciviousness is causing our young people to lose their soul. Not to mention the immodesty, the music, the association of what goes on after it. When you think of prom, and I mean, we could go on and on. I don't want to be around the drugs. I don't want to be around those who are just using filthy language all the time. I don't want to go to the bar. You fill in the blank. Because I abhor evil. I don't want anything to do with it. And I don't want anybody around me to have anything to do with it. 1 Corinthians 13:6, continuing with this idea of love and hating iniquity, this is the love chapter, right? If there's a place where we can learn about love, it's 1 Corinthians 13. What does he say in verse 6? Love rejoices not in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. That is biblical love, over and over and over again. Hate sin, but love the sinner. We say that often. This idea of that's going around about this bigotry and, you know, the hatred towards homosexuality or homosexuals, the hatred better not be towards the people. It better not be. And if it is, then we're wrong in that. The hatred is about the sin. That's what we hate. But you know what? We hate any other sin as well, just as much. We ought to. It's all sin. It all hurts us and separates us from Almighty God. Romans chapter 1. Let's go to this one together. Romans chapter 1. Verse 32. Romans 1, verse 32. Let's turn here. I want you to read this one with me. Who knowing, Paul writing Romans 1, 32, who knowing the judgment of God, they which commit such things are worthy of death. Now the such things that he mentions are about verses 18 all the way up to this point. Just a laundry list of sins. Included in that is homosexuality. Young people, included in that is disobedient to parents. There's gossip. There, anything you can imagine, it's just about in this list. They that commit such things are worthy of death. Okay, now look at verse 32. Let's finish it. Not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them. Anybody in here, and I don't want you to say anything out loud, but just raise your hand. Does anybody ever have an American Standard Version of the Bible, 1901? A couple of you do? Okay. I want you to look in your Bible, because if I'm not mistaken, the American Standard, which is a very reliable translation, uses the word consent here. That's what he's talking about. He says, you do not consent in them either, have pleasure in them. That those C words we talked about in the beginning, he's not talking about participating here. He says, not only should you not participate, but those who are not doing anything about it. Those who are acting like they approve of it because they're really not in opposition. They're consenting. Right? He says they're just as guilty. They're also worthy of death. Christianity is militant. I want you to think about for a moment 1 Timothy 6 and verse 12. He says, fight the good fight. In fact, go to 2 Timothy with me. One more thought on this and we'll move on. I'm spending a lot of time on it, but I want to bring this out as well. Just so that, again, I don't want there to be any doubt in your minds. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 3. He says in 1 Timothy 6:12, fight the good fight. I want you to think about a soldier for a moment, because as Christians, we are fighters, or should be, as soldiers. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3. Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Now look at verse 4. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. He says a soldier is not going to entangle himself in the very things that he's fighting to get rid of. Could you imagine? Let's just take a soldier for a moment and put him overseas. There's some awful things going on. Lives, innocent lives are being taken over their beliefs. Christians who are being killed. Let's put a soldier over there who's fighting to try to relieve them, to help them. If a soldier just goes and right in the middle, with all that going on around him, he just crosses his hands and just stands there, what kind of soldier is he? He's not a soldier at all. He's not a soldier. What's he going to do? He's going to fight. He's going to be in opposition. Well, he's not participating or helping them kill those people. He's not condoning or accepting that. But nobody would argue, that that soldier was a good soldier when he just stood there and didn't do anything about it either. We are, as Christians, soldiers. What statement are we making if we're going to be there and just stand and watch the very thing that we're trying to fight go on around us? We're not a very good soldier if that's the case. Let's move on, though. We've spent a lot of time on the attitude. Last point, and we'll just take a moment because I know my time is going by very quickly. Appearance. One last thing, appearance. And this one is very simple. Won't take much time. Romans 14 and verse 6. Let not, therefore, your good be evil spoken of. The good that we do can be called evil. What a tragedy it would be to have the inward part right, to have our heart in the right place, but to ruin it by the outward appearance. Let me give an example that just happened a moment ago, just because it's for some reason on my mind. I sat down, and my sweet wife was not on the pew with me. We're talking about appearance, and one of our elders turns around and says, "You must be having marital problems." She wasn't sitting with me. And then, of course, Glenn mentioned it up here, and I'm joking, of course, and I knew he was joking. But we can, in a more serious note, we can, by our appearance, give an improper image. And therefore, sin, even though it might not inherently be sinful. The picture I have up here, let me bring it back up a little larger. When I was, I don't remember how old I was, but I'm embarrassed to say that I used to eat these little candy sticks. And there's nothing wrong with these candy sticks. They're just little white things. I thought it was cool that they came in the superhero boxes. And I remember getting one. And my friends and I, for whatever reason, we thought it would be cool to take this white candy stick, you know where I'm going with this, put it between our fingers and put it up to our mouth. Is there anything wrong with a candy stick being between two fingers? No. Is there anything wrong with touching the candy stick to your lip? Well, no. But is there anything wrong with doing that? Why? Of course there is. Why? Because it's an improper appearance. I won't even tell you about that. But anyways, if somebody saw, you know, that was not a good time in my life. I'll put it that way. I was not very faithful during that time. But if somebody had seen that from across the way, what would it have looked like I was doing? Smoking. It looked like I was smoking. Let's say you go into the grocery store and you buy a drink. Let's say you get a root beer or a Coke or something, and it's in a bottle. And let's just say you decided to take a brown paper bag for some strange reason, and you wrap that bottle up in a brown paper bag and you go through the store drinking that soda. Well, guess what? Nothing wrong with drinking a soda. But what is the appearance? What am I going to think when I see you, when I see Carlos Dawson walking through drinking a bottle with a brown bag around it? I'm going to think, what is he drinking? Right? Well, he just messed up, or I just messed up. Why? Because we're giving that improper appearance. Our good might be evil spoken of because it appears that we're doing evil. Right? You know 1 Thessalonians 5 verse 22 as well. Abstain from every or all appearances, every appearance of evil. Don't allow yourself to be put in a place where it's going to look like you're doing wrong. You're in that bar and you walk out, what's it going to look like you probably were doing? What are people to assume? Right? Young people, you go to the prom. Well, they probably danced. Maybe you didn't. But guess what? There's an appearance there. I want to close. I want to say more about that. But I want to just end with this final thought because I think this is important. Sometimes we ask this question too about association. Why don't we, as the Lord's body, associate and kind of join efforts with denominations, with particular things? Why don't we kind of join them in functions that we might not necessarily have an issue with as to what they're doing? I want you to go to 2 John with me, talking about this idea of association and appearance. 2 John, there's only one chapter. We're going to look at verses 9 and 10. And then the lesson will be yours. Notice 2 John, verse 9. Whosoever transgresseth and abideth not in the doctrine of Christ. Okay, we're talking about religious groups that it may be in many ways they are, but in some very major ways in regards to their worship and salvation, they're not abiding in the doctrine of Christ. And so it says, they hath not God. He that abideth in the doctrine of Christ, he hath both the Father and the Son. Now look at verse 10. If there come any unto you and bring not this doctrine, receive him not into your house, neither bid him Godspeed. He says, you can't receive them into your house. That doesn't mean that you can't invite them in and study with them. It doesn't mean that you're not to be friendly with them. But you can't lodge them as to expedite their activities or that doctrine. Okay? In other words, as he later says there, you cannot bid them Godspeed. We can't encourage that. We can't do that. Again, there are things that may not be inherently wrong, but because of our association or because of appearance in this case, they are. We're guilty because of the way that something looks or something that might get misconstrued, like bidding someone Godspeed that we ought not, or like drinking a bottle in a paper bag that gives that a wrong appearance. I know I didn't spend much time on that, but let me just conclude by saying this. I hope that you believe and that you see without a shadow of a doubt that there is a such thing as being guilty by association. We need to acknowledge that line is there. There's a line, and we need not be unequally yoked with those unfruitful works of darkness. We need to, and it's not a, you know, I'm stuck up, I'm better than you, holier than thou. It's not about that. It's about living on the side that Christ would have us to live on. Living in the light and helping as many others as we can to get there. And being associated with that sin is not going to do it. We need to recognize and have that attitude of biblical love. Love that is willing to expose and to rebuke that sin. Love that abhors that wickedness and doesn't want anything to do with it. And finally, to be careful about our appearance and what might appear to be evil, even though initially there's nothing wrong with it, it's going to give the wrong image. We need to be careful about that and not let the good things we're doing be evil spoken of. Don't be guilty by association. If you're here tonight and you're not a child of God, we want to encourage you to do that. To put on Christ in baptism, if you believe and are willing to repent of sin and confess His name, you can do that tonight. Maybe it is that you are guilty of sin, whether it be by association or in some other way. We don't want you to leave here tonight not knowing that your heart is right with God, that your attitude, that your soul, that your life is committed to Him. If there's any doubt in your mind, let's make that right. Be sure that you're right with God right now as we stand and sing together.